Hey, I shave before I go on this show. You are you saying you guys don't?
My legs get a little raw when I do, so. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the episode 26 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. On our panel today, and when we do our introductions, we keep hearing that Josh is a stealth entrepreneur, so I thought it would be fun today in our introductions if we all guess what his stealth entrepreneurship is, what his company does.
Oh, that is so not fair.
So, on our panel this week, we have Abdi Grimm.
Good morning, and or good evening, or good night, depending on where you are and when you're listening to this, and I'm going to guess... that it has something to do with office furniture.
All right. James Edward Gray.
Hey, everybody. It's James here. And if I had to guess what Josh Sesser does in his stealth entrepreneur stuff, it would be kitchen appliances.
All right. We also have David Brady.
Hey, it's David Brady here. I blog at heartmindcode.com, and I said the last time I was on that ADDcast isn't dead. We've actually got a new episode going up probably tomorrow, and so that's going on. And I think Josh's startup is he's going to start a podcast with several Ruby experts. And he's gonna, when he goes live with it, he's gonna have like 26 episodes all ready to go.
All right. And Josh, go ahead.
So I really have no idea what to guess here.
It's
a total mystery to me. But I like all your ideas. I think I'm gonna pursue all of them.
All right. And I'm Charles Maxwood, and I'm leaning more toward a sock deodorizer delivery company.
Or deodorant. Yeah, just deodorant.
Deodorant. Yeah, we were talking about that before the show. So this week we're going to be talking about pairing. I know that several of us have experience with pairing. Some of us have worked in companies where it's been done pretty much all the time. Others of us have, you know, we're freelance or consultants. And
wait, do we need a sommelier on the show now to talk about pairing our wine with our meal?
Absolutely.
You are writing C code, monsieur. I recommend the crotchety old neck beard.
Oh, man.
If you think this episode is off to a bad start, you should have heard the pre-show chatter.
Oh, no kidding. I've actually had somebody come to me and ask to be on one of my podcasts, and he told me that he was a neckbeard. And I don't know, is that something that you can actually claim?
It's the verification I worry about.
Okay, So wine and cheese aside, you know, pairing, we're actually talking about pair programming.
Wait, what?
Correct.
We are?
Yes, sorry to shock you guys.
I've heard that you've actually spoken on this before, Josh. Why don't you give us some insight?
Define it.
Define
it. Definition.
Definition.
It's a programming activity that requires furniture that I've invented.
Well, it doesn't require it, but you're definitely better off with it. Now, pair programming, it's when two people collaborate on a programming task together. And there's a lot of different ways to do it, and I guess that's what we're going to be spending the next 40 minutes talking about.
Right. So that leads me to a question, because it seems like kind of a loose definition. If I pull a couple of developers aside and you know, we start talking about, well, how do we want to put this together, and we chat about it for 10 or 15 minutes, kind of get a game plan together, and then go split back up. Is that pair programming then?
I wouldn't call it pair programming.
Right. So it's more than just a couple of people collaborating over some programming problem.
Right. So the typical pair programming day that is the bread and butter of life at Pivotal Labs, where I spent 4 years, is you have one, typically it's an iMac, you have, you know, one big monitor and two keyboards and two mice, so that you don't have, so that it's easy for each person to type and drive when they want to. And also during cold and flu season, you don't have to worry about germs. And that's not a joke. That's actually important. but two people sitting side by side, looking at the same screen at the same time, and both people are engaged in the programming task. So there's a lot of different perspectives about how you how the two different people take on roles during pair programming. Some people talk about the person who's driving and the person who's navigating. I'm making air quotes with my fingers, which is horribly effective on podcasts. So there's the driver and the navigator. That's not how I like to do it. I like to have both people engaged in driving. So that's, you know, both people are coding at the same time, although both people aren't typing at the same time. That's probably the number one cause of injuries during pair programming.
Is injury a common problem?
Simultaneous typing. Mostly because, if you type while Josh is typing, he will smack you. Look what you made me do!
And we haven't even paired together.
I've heard the stories.
So there are some people who, like, they think pair programming is about one person sitting there dictating while the other person types. And that's not what it's about. And it's also not about one person doing all the work while the other person observes. It's about both people being intellectually engaged in the activity that's going on right at the moment. So that said, there are often different roles that occur. One of the ways that you can slice up a programming task is, especially if you're doing test-driven development, the pair will be talking about a problem. And they'll say, "Okay, great. Here's something we want to do. We want to add a field to this form that asks for someone's middle name." And one person will write a test for it, and then the other person will make that test pass. And then once they've made the test pass, they'll write another test that fails, and then the other person will. And then so we call that ping pong pairing. You know, I'll make a test, you make it pass, then you make a test, and I'll make it pass. So that's a typical day.
Okay, so I admit that I am absolutely the least experienced pair programmer on this call. I just learned a few seconds ago that pair programming does not mean having sex while you program. So I'm playing catch up here. But
So James, I do have to put a disclaimer in. In 1 year at Pivotal, I was like working on a lot of different projects with a lot of different people, and I ended up pairing with like over 24 people in that year, and I kind of got the reputation as the office slut.
Nice.
I was worried I got a TDD, but I got unit tested and it was okay.
Nice.
Oh, man.
But you got to remember, whenever you pair with someone, you're programming with everyone they've ever programmed with.
Nice.
Oh, that's nasty.
But it's true.
I now understand why you guys lobbied to do this episode. Okay, getting back on topic, or trying to, can we talk about, like, some of the benefits? Why would you pair a program? I mean, if you just think about it in a simple sense, it seems like that, you know, it takes two programmers where you're only getting one right thing done. So it seems like right you're actually doing less.
Right. So there actually have been some studies about the productivity of teams that use pair programming. And it doesn't take twice as long to do everything because you have two people doing the work one person would be doing. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Pair programming teams can be more productive. So per capita, I guess is the term. So I think as programmers, we all have some experience with code review and how, you know, you write some code, you show it to somebody else, and they're like, "Why did you do that? Why did you write this 50-line method when you just could have made this one API call?" So if you say, the longer I wait to get that code review, the more problems that someone will find with my code. So you want to tighten that feedback cycle. The tightest you can make that cycle is that somebody is watching you write your code while you write it. So pair programming has often been sold to development managers as it's instantaneous code review.
Okay, so I want to jump in here real quick because you're talking about some studies that said that pair programming can be more productive, and that just ties back to another issue that I have with programming metrics in general, and that is that how do you measure productive? Do you measure it in lines of code? Do you measure it in the number of features? Do you measure it in because not all lines of code are created equal, not all features are created equal, not all anything is created equal, and so it's really hard for me to really buy into being able to prove that it's more productive. I think you can kind of get a sense of how productive you are, and I think some people and some pairs are more productive than others, maybe to the point where things where you're actually more productive together than apart. But I'm not sure if I buy that pair programming is necessarily always or even most of the time is more productive.
So I want to jump in there because there's a couple of things I think people don't always consider when they think about would this be more productive or more effective, and when they just think about, okay, so there's two programmers working on the same problem when they could be working on two different problems concurrently. So the first one is that code review point. I cannot tell you how many times I've come across code that if there had been one other person at that keyboard, at that screen, they would have caught the bug. They would have caught the complete brain fart that went into production code. The other day, I discovered that some code had some latent bugs because the spec for it had failed. They basically put typos in the spec, so the spec wasn't actually asserting anything. So the spec had left out the should equal part of the assertions, and so the assertions did nothing, and so it was the specs were all passing, but they were actually not verifying anything. And that's the sort of thing that when I'm pairing with somebody never gets through, or very rarely gets through. It's also the sort of thing that may get through even in a formal code review, just because code reviews are boring. People want to get through them. But the other thing is, I think the idea of, of these two programmers could be twice as productive if they were both working on separate problems leaves out the fact that not everyone is working at 100% all the time. And when you look at, a typical programmer day, are you really completely engaged the whole time you're working on a problem? And what I see with pairing is it really ramps up your level of engagement. Like if you're working with someone else, with the occasional exception of spontaneous conversations that break out, which doesn't happen as often as you might think once you get to know each other, you're just completely focused on the problem.
Which is an important thing to happen too.
Oh, it is. But it's absolutely important. But what I find is that, most of the pair programming time that I see is completely engaged with the problem at hand. The entire, except for, the breaks that you take, you might have 4 hours of just exhausting, totally focused on the problem time. And, I don't really see that as often when people are coding alone, especially if the problem isn't that interesting. You might see that if somebody's working on a super interesting problem and they're just really excited about it. We've all done those all-nighters on a super interesting problem. But when it's less interesting, I think the pairing really brings up the level of engagement.
Yeah. Yeah, I always, whenever I see a Star Trek Next Generation episode and two people are working on something together and they're just like talking about their personal lives while they're working, I think these guys suck at pair programming.
That's awesome.
So, Abdi, you kind of mentioned that when two people pair, it kind of raises the quality floor. I've also had the experience where it also raises the effectiveness ceiling of the pair, where this has only happened to me maybe a dozen times in my career. But it's almost magical when it happens. But I've gotten to the end of a long day of pair programming where we have really, really gelled. And then we turn around and we look at what we just did, and both of us realize there is no way a single human brain could have solved that problem. The gestalt of two programmers well gelled was more than just having two people work on the same problem. It was like having a single pair that has a lot more brain width available than a single human being to bring to the problem. And just like really tough problems just get cracked as a result. It's really, really cool.
You actually brought to mind something else that I left out. What also happens with pairing is it's less likely that you will go down a blind alley or down a rabbit hole. If you start to go down a rabbit hole, it's far more likely when you have two people that one of them will say, you know what? This looks like a rabbit hole. Can we somehow avoid this altogether? So I can't tell you how many times I've been pairing on a problem, and it was something where I would have just kept plugging away, going down that rabbit hole hour after hour, and instead my pair said, "Do we actually have to do this at all?" And we went and talked to the stakeholder, and they said, "Yeah, actually, you don't really need to do that." And just that, that could save you an entire day of work. Mm-hmm. Just that, having someone there to say, do we actually have to do this? And so, I think that's another of those things that's easy to miss about the productivity aspect.
So I wanted to talk about that a little. I've noticed that there are certain kinds of people I like pairing with more. For example, one of my big problems is I will just... solve a problem. Whenever someone gives me a problem, then I just solve it. And I don't think about it or decide or whatever. It's can you do X? And I'm like, yep, sure can. And I just go do that. But I've actually paired with people in the past that were very good at saying, yeah, we could do X, but it's probably a lot easier to do Y. We can do that in a lot less time and would probably give you what you want anyway, and kind of what Avdi was talking about there, is this really important? Is this the right way to go? And I think when I'm pairing with those people, I find that it saves everyone involved a dramatic amount of time because if they ask me for something, I just do it, even if it's a bad idea. Whereas a lot of other people are good about saying, should we be doing this? And then they get that redirected back to what would be better for us to be working on.
I've actually seen a really interesting variation on that, which is maybe this is to be filed under the when pair programming goes wrong kind of thing, but where one of us will say, let's do the problem this way. And the other one says, I don't know that that makes any sense maybe we should try it this other way. And the other person says, no, I want to do it this way. We're going to do it this way. And so it's kind of frustrating. There's a little bit of a disconnect there and you kind of grind wheels. And on this project that I'm currently on, I'd say about 50-50, half the time we get to the end. And when I've been the person that's been kind of shouted down by my partner, about half the time we get to the end and I go, or about halfway through, I finally see what they're doing. And I'm like, oh, okay, that actually makes sense. And I just learned something from it. And so there's some very important knowledge transfer and very useful for me to sit back and go, now how come he looked at that and just saw it immediately and I had to be led by the nose through this to reach this solution? The other half of the time we get to the end of it and I just kind of facepalm and say, see, I told you so. because the solution we end up is this awful Frankenstein. And the really cool thing, and this gets into like what I mentioned with Avdi, where the conversations and the chit chat between people is really essential, not just knowledge transfer, but also like social capital exchange between programmers, where they learn to gel and they learn to trust each other and work to and learn to like each other and that sort of thing. And because that had happened last week, I had a moment where we got to the end of the thing, and the thing that I'd been questioning the entire time, and my pair had been saying, no, we should do it this way. We should do this. We got to the end, and my pair said, oh, wow, we really shouldn't have done it that way. You were right. And that was a very useful, like it was the opposite happened. He was the one going, how come Dave saw that right from the very beginning? And also, it was also very validating, and it was very, you know, like social capital was exchanged there of saying, okay, you value my opinion. I'm glad. I value your opinion. This is good to go.
I don't want us to move on from the benefits just yet, because I think that it's good to enumerate them. So we were talking about productivity. We're talking about code quality. Just real quickly, there's a couple others. Sharing information or transmitting information. And so if every problem is being worked on by two people, then there's never, you know, so it pretty much automatically doubles your bus number. You know, people know the term bus number. It's like, if, you know, so anyway.
Definitely.
So, go ahead.
No, okay, so the bus number is the number of people that if they were spontaneously hit by buses would completely hobble your ability to move forward. I'm not defining this very well, but basically it's about knowledge, knowledge silos.
Yeah, the number of people that if they were hit by a bus, this bit of lore or knowledge would be lost to the organization.
Right. Yeah.
So, higher bus number is it's better.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and especially if you're changing, changing pairs frequently throughout a project, then everybody sees every bit of code. It breaks down that sense of territoriality in the code. And so, there's less defensiveness about code, and just everybody knows what's going on in the whole project. And none of that, but the way that I learn how to do a lot of things in the last couple of years was pairing with people who knew how to do them better than I did. So,
and
I've also spent a lot of time mentoring people and pairing with them. And it's just so much more effective to show somebody how to do it and guide them in their own leveling up and how to do it than any other way.
I want to chime in on that real quick too, because I've paired with several people, including Dave, actually. We used to work together. And I swear there were some times where we sat down, and Dave has a lot more experience than I have. And there were times where I swear we'd sit down, and somehow he was still learning as much from me as I was from him, even though I was kind of the junior guy and he was kind of the senior guy. You know, where, yeah, there were some things that I had picked up, some ways that I had learned to cope with my deficiencies that he had never seen before. And and just the same, you know, he was imparting some wisdom that he had gained over, I don't know how many years of programming that that I picked up and appreciated. So it goes both ways.
You forget why you know something, and somebody comes along and challenges your assumptions, and you're like, oh, well, let's talk about that. And yeah, it's if you want to learn something, teach it to somebody. That's absolutely true.
I hear people ask all the time, you know, how do we spread our knowledge and our practices consistently around the team? And my answer is always just pair program a lot. I mean, you don't need anything else once you start pair programming a lot. It'll just everything will just the idioms and the knowledge and everything will spread out.
The anti-pattern to that is bringing in your expert programmers, making them work on the hard stuff, and making the newer guys work on the easy stuff, because then no knowledge gets disseminated.
Right. But
a lot of people do it.
Right. And the cool thing about this that was incorporated into how Pivotal does work with client developers is that if you start a project with a bunch of Pivot developers and the client hasn't hired any developers yet, which is common when you got startups just ramping up, then as the client would hire developers, they would join the team. Some pivots would roll off the team, And eventually you'd have, you know, a team staffed of, you know, pivots and clients, and then you just pair program together for some length of time. And when the engagement is over, the client developers know everything about the code. There's no handoff. There's no, I have to write, you know, 300 pages of documentation about how this code works. Everybody just already knows how it works. And they, and one day they just start going to work at their own office rather than, you know, coming into Pivotal, and they move forward. So it's the easiest handoff ever.
The other interesting thing, though, is that you're not just handing off the knowledge of the code base, but you're handing off the way that you built it. You're handing off cultural aspects and things like that. And so it's an excellent way of maintaining not only the integrity of the code base, but the integrity of the company and the integrity of the team.
It's equally valuable to have somebody say, let's solve this using a class instance variable, as it is to have somebody say, whoa, don't push that to the server. We haven't run our specs yet.
Yeah, well said. So, and then productivity, I think, is actually a significant benefit. And it's not just the number of lines of code per day that you're creating. It's that studies have shown that pair programming produces higher quality code because you got the code review thing going on all the time. And the maintenance cost of the code over time, lower bug counts. So it's higher quality, you got lower defect rates, fewer failed launches, and the maintainability of the code over time is much greater, especially since because of the knowledge transmission, more people on the team are familiar with more of the code, so you don't have these confusion moments when a bug breaks and nobody knows, you know, the guy who wrote the code is on vacation and nobody knows how to fix it. So the if you look at two teams and one is doing pair programming and the other is not, that it can be much more productive.
Okay, but let's be honest, isn't the productivity just because you're too embarrassed to look at your Twitter account while some guy's watching over your shoulder?
I'm not.
To be fair, yes.
I was going to ask about that. When you take a break, do you pair Facebook?
That's awesome. No.
Pair tweeting.
But that's actually a really good point, James, that like Avdi said earlier, it keeps you focused on the task and you don't spend all day sitting there in IRC or Facebook, just dicking around. But the downside of that, and not everything is a garden of roses. You know, pair programming for 8 hours a day is incredibly hard work.
Yeah.
Yep. Agreed.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. I find it harder to psych myself up for it.
You know, I want to jump in here real quick because I've noticed that a lot of the things that you guys are talking about are things that kind of come after you've been pairing for a while, as opposed to necessarily when when you haven't been pairing for a while and you're just trying it out. I've seen a lot of friction with just getting started, where people, they don't gel well, or they don't know how to communicate when they're pairing, or things like that. What tips do you guys have for people who are new to pairing that are just trying to get started and get used to some of the benefits that it offers?
So I'll just do my little, pairing for newbies spiel, which is that an important thing about if you're going to pair program together every day is that you should have a neutral setup for doing your pairing on. You should not be pair programming on one person's computer, and ideally you shouldn't be having one person visit the other person in his office. You should have neutral territory that is configured in a way that everybody on the team can use that hardware equivalently well. And the reason for that is the power dynamic of being in my office, working on my computer with all of my software shortcuts and all of my configuration, is going to be more difficult for you to operate as an equal partner when we're pairing.
Mm-hmm.
In a shop that does pairing well, they have a bunch of pairing workstations set up. Usually it's a great big screen and two keyboards and two mice and whatever ergonomic accommodations you have, and a box of mints and some hand sanitizer and whatever else you need to get going, and you sit together working at the computer together during the day, and you don't have to worry about the power dynamic of who owns what and is somebody a guest there.
Well, I've actually paired with somebody where I didn't really feel like he was more in charge, even though we were working on his machine. But I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what I was doing with Emacs while I was trying to program. And that can be distracting. I can see exactly what you're talking about there.
Oh, yeah. You have to have an editor that you're both comfortable with.
Yes. Yep.
Isn't that kind of one advantage of remote pairing I've found that, if you're just launching up a Skype session and, one of you shares your screen for a while and then the other one shares the screen for a while. I found the cool thing about that is when you're programming, you get to use your shortcuts and what's comfy for you. And, and all they have to do is read code. So that's fine. They can handle that even if you're in Emacs, when the other guy's programming, he's doing it his way. And again, all you have to do is read. So that seems to be kind of one of the advantages of remote pairing.
I think it depends. I think if you're both controlling a remote machine where you're using Emacs or what's the other screen, then it might be a little bit harder. But if I'm coding up something and you're watching me and then we just switch to see your screen instead of mine, then yeah, I think that would work just fine.
Yeah. You can lose context when you do that, though.
It's true. You can lose some context. On the subject of tips for getting started, I actually want to push back a little bit on one of Josh's earlier points about the roles in pairing. So I talked to a programmer at a recent conference, and she was saying, we've been trying to do some pairing, but it feels like it's just I'm sitting there writing the code, and my pair is just kind of looking over my shoulder, nodding his head. And saying, yeah, that looks good. And I explained, well, when I'm pairing, I'm watching somebody else. If I'm not at the keyboard, then I'm watching somebody else code, and I'm basically telling them what to do, basically telling them what to type, what to do next. And they're welcome to object at any point or to say, well, are you sure about that? But I want to say something for especially for beginners. I want to say something in favor of like the traditional navigation slash driving school of pair programming, because if you at least start out practicing those roles with some discipline, it really forces, so the person navigating, that's the person off the keyboard, they have to figure out, they are responsible for what code gets written, for what we do next. And they have to figure out how to communicate their ideas without just pushing the other person aside and saying, here, let me type this. They have to figure out how to actually enunciate their ideas, which often helps them either flesh out their ideas or realize that there's something wrong with their ideas. And conversely, the person at the keyboard is in a mode where they're really absorbing what's somebody else's perspective rather than sitting there and just like doing their own thing and just getting approval periodically. They're basically almost acting as somebody else's hands and getting that hands-on feel for how somebody else thinks. And what I do see in a lot of cases, I see beginners at pair programming falling into the system of one person at the keyboard doing all of the work and the person over their shoulder just sort of nodding and smiling periodically. And so I do recommend at least getting started trying out those kind of strict navigator driver roles.
Well, we all need to take turns exercising our necks, nodding every once in a while.
Yeah. So Avdi, I'll agree with everything you said. I think that's the driving navigating setup can work great for bringing someone up to speed and training.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed too when I'm navigating as opposed to driving is that since I'm not concentrating on getting it into the machine, running the tests, doing all of the other stuff, you know, I can kind of half watch and make sure that that all happens right. But I tend to be able to spare more brain cycles for solving the problem. And so in a lot of cases, you know, I can get two or three steps ahead and be thinking about things while my pair is doing the work of getting it into the machine and, you know, typing it out so that when we move on to the next stage of the problem, then I'm ready to make my contribution.
I think what Chuck just said there is kind of important. One of the things I was going to say that I've learned in doing it, when I first started pairing, my instinct was I need to talk a lot and contribute a lot and make sure I'm pulling my weight. And I think I was really annoying the pair most of the time, you know, because they're trying to think and you're breaking that mental stack. And I think as I've gotten better at it, I've learned mostly just to shut up a lot, you know, and that, you know, if they're flowing and moving forward, great. Then my job is to sit there, observe what they're doing, look for problems, like Chuck said, potentially think ahead. You know, and then I usually find when they pause or stop or get stuck, that's usually a signal for me that I've been sitting there thinking and I've got the next idea. So I just toss that out there, you know, and then that usually gets us moving forward again. And that seems to make the process a lot smoother.
So there's, you know, so every front has a back. You know, there's two sides to that. And I think that you can use that to your advantage sometimes, but there is a downside to that, and that's that you're not as fully engaged in what your pair is doing at the moment, and you're not going to be as good at catching the bugs or the thought mistakes that he's making while he's working.
Yeah. Josh, you just used the magic word there, engagement. For me, it's all about engagement. And if pairing is going badly, it's because it's almost always because we're not as engaged as we need to be. And I find that if I find myself typing, doing all the typing, and my partner is silently nodding, I start thinking, how can I get this guy engaged? And the easiest way to get your partner engaged is to give him the keyboard. I won't completely disagree with James on the being quiet, because I was about to jump in and say no. 9 times out of 10, if you're having trouble pairing, it's because you're not talking enough. I find myself, especially navigating, when my partner is driving off into the weeds and he's not telling me where he's going or what he's doing. That's when I start kind of getting in his face and saying, "Talk to me. Tell me where you're mm-hmm. going. Yep. I need to engage with you.
Talk to me, Goose. Talk to me."
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, if you're well synced and he's cruising, then absolutely. But the majority thing I think newbies fall into, the pitfall, is that the navigator doesn't work hard enough when newbies are starting out. So I have ADD. Some of you may have read about this somewhere, but I used to bring my laptop to pair program with, and there are some people that absolutely forbid laptops because it's a distraction, right? If you're navigating and you're typing away in your laptop, especially because I've got Twitter open and Facebook open, this is really bad etiquette for pairing and that sort of thing. And, but if your partner is typing something and is like, "Oh crap, how do I do this?" and I've got it Googled and pulled up on my laptop before he's even finished asking the question, I feel like I'm doing a good job as the navigator. If I find myself spending too much time on Twitter, which is not zero, I'll allow, you know, myself to tweet. My partner says something funny, that's going on Twitter. But if it's like he's writing code while I'm writing on Twitter, that's, you know what, it's time to close the laptop. The value of navigator having access to Google is being completely, you know, subverted by the navigator having access to distractions. So it's all it all comes down to just one word: engagement. How tightly engaged are you?
Yeah, I'm saying some people like to have separate computers for people to do research on, and then have the pairing computer where you do all your coding. And other shops just say no distractions, no other computers. Everything you do is both people have their attention on the same place.
Not so for you.
Yeah.
I will say if you're at the keyboard, you know, and you feel like your partner might be slipping away somewhere. And don't be afraid to just say, okay, just sort of lift your hands up and say, okay, what next? What do I do? Just, you know, don't be afraid. I think maybe some people are afraid to be dumb when they're at the keyboard. You know, they're afraid to look dumb or look like they're at a loss. But I think that's fine. You know, I think it's completely fine to just periodically say, okay, what next? You know, I do that a lot when I'm at the keyboard.
Yeah. So the thing that – I actually tweeted this yesterday, but the thing that I want to say to people who are new to pair programming is that like any other thing that you do as a programmer, pair programming is a learned skill.
Yes.
It's not something that you just take to naturally. And for many people, it's a very challenging skill to learn. But – and I remember Obi Fernandez wrote this post a couple years ago talking about how pair programming isn't for everyone, and like it was this elitist thing that only some people were capable of doing, and it caused a lot of ruckus when he did that. But my response to that is that it's a skill, and most people don't like doing things that they're not very good at. They struggle with it. They find it unsatisfying. And if you can learn the skill, have some patience and give yourself the time to learn the skill. When you get good enough at doing it, you'll actually enjoy it, and you'll find yourself, you know, getting the benefits of pair programming rather than hating it and struggling with it.
Yeah, I try to tell programmers that are new to pairing, especially if they're good programmers, is to say, be patient with this. Remember that your entire skill set does not translate here. You learned to program alone. You learned to program in the quiet. You learned to program in the silence of your own head. None of those skills are going to translate here. In fact, they're actually going to hamstring you. Be patient. Be willing to suck at this and talk to me. Get your brain out there so that we can integrate.
So I have one more question. I wanted to ask about remote pairing because a lot of this pair programming talk that we've had has been focused around, you know, sitting next to the guy that we're pairing with. But what if we're sitting across the world from the guy that we're pairing with? Are there any tricks to that? Is there something different about that?
There are, and I've done, you know, a fair amount of remote pairing. I think Avdi's done a bunch of remote pairing too. But I have a pick for that, so I'm like, I don't want to talk too much about it. And I have an important thing to add before we jump into the picks or what have you. So I want to drop this one message in here, which I think is more important than remote pairing, and that if you talk to people who pair a lot, they'll say that the most important thing for being able to operate effectively pair programming is that you have to get your ego in check. Mm-hmm. And so if you've ever seen like a tight jazz group jamming out, it's, you know, the drummer is not trying to hit his drum as hard and as loud and as fast as possible. He's listening for the places where he can do something that's going to complement what other people are doing, where he can do something that's going to make the song sound better.
Yeah.
And when you're pairing with somebody, it's not about typing all the time. It's not about you driving all the time. It's not about you getting your own way all the time. When you're doing it right, you get your ego in check, and it stops being about you showing off and you getting your way and you demonstrating that you're smarter or you know what's going on. And it's about the two of you working together. You become kind of a group mind, and you just focus on the task, and it stops being about you and what you can do, and it becomes being about what you can do together as a pair.
Yeah. That's awesome. I have a very urgent pairing message as well, which speaks very much to Josh's point about there really ought to be a neutral machine. I don't think I've ever paired in a company where there was a neutral machine. So I have invaded other people's laptops. Other people have moved into my machine. I've basically forced myself to become fluent in Vim and in TextMate, even though Emacs is my editor of choice. Just because if Vim is your editor of choice, then I want to reduce any kind of barrier that you have to the pairing, because I think that's more valuable. I think the text editor is not the bottleneck when you're pair programming. And the urgent message that I have to anybody out there is that if I have paired with you and your machine is still locked in the Dvorak key layout, shift control backtick is the combination that will unlock it. And I'm very sorry. Anybody who's paired with me, that's the first thing I do is I turn on Dvorak keyboard layout, and then I go enable Control Shift backtick to toggle between US and Dvorak layout. And then invariably, about once a year, somebody will say, I can't log in. And I'm like, oh, and you can't tell me your password. Okay, let me go print out you a picture of the Dvorak keyboard. And they play a little geography matching game to try and figure out how to type their password.
Yeah,
David was the kind of jerk that in high school, when you asked to borrow his calculator, he handed you that thing in RPN mode, you know? You couldn't use it anyway. And the fact that I know that says nothing about the kind of jerk I was in high school.
All right. Well, let's do the picks. Let's go ahead and start off with Avdi.
All right. I think just one pick today, and it's going to be Google Plus Hangouts, which are probably the best way to have distributed team stand-up meetings that I've seen yet, and they're 100% freer than all of the other lower quality solutions. At least right now, it is. So yeah, love doing stand-ups on Google Plus. Actually, can I do a quick self plug? I don't know if it's really a pick, but just on the topic of remote pairing, I have a whole podcast dedicated to distributed team issues. Wideteams.com is the address, and so if you're interested in remote pairing and stuff like that, I've interviewed dozens of programmers and people involved in software in distributed software teams on that podcast. So you might find some interesting stuff there.
Sounds good. Dave, do you have your mic set in Dvorak yet?
Yes. Okay, so I have two picks, both for pair programming. The first one is Qido, Q-I-D-O, and I'll put a link in the show notes to that, which is it's a little USB key dongle, and it looks like a USB, you know, like a thumb drive, except that it's got a USB port on the back end of it. And what it is you plug it into the back of a computer, and the computer says, oh, hey, there's a keyboard here. And then you plug in a USB keyboard to it, and I can type on that USB keyboard. I can type on it in Dvorak with no translation. The keyboard is sending QWERTY. It hits this little Qido, which stands for QWERTY in Dvorak out, and it translates it out to the Dvorak layout. And so I can type the home row, ASDF, and it goes through, or rather I can type my home row, which is AOEU, and it goes through the Qido and it comes out as ASDF, or vice versa. It's actually vice versa. So the end result is that I can sit down at your computer and I can plug this thing in, and I can plug my external keyboard in, and your keyboard is in QWERTY, my keyboard is in Dvorak, and there was no software driver, and you don't have to remember that stupid shift control backtick thing to get out of QWERTY and Dvorak.
That's kind of awesome.
it's really, really slick. And the people that I have pair programmed with really, really love it, especially the ones that I've ever locked out of being able to log in. And so it will make your sysadmin freak out because it looks like a keylogger. And in fact, it is made by keyghost.com, who makes keyloggers. And just somebody on the at the company said, hey, we make these things that make keyloggers. Why don't we make one that makes a key translator? And so that's what they do. And my
it's
other,
a key translator, I promise.
Yeah, exactly. Just type your password here. And my second pick for pair programming is Dove Men's Care products. Specifically, they have an entire line of deodorants that are not antiperspirants. I am allergic to most antiperspirants, like aluminum hydroxide. I break out. I'm not really like allergic. It just gives me a rash, and it's very uncomfortable, and I don't like to wear it. And as long as I'm in a dry climate, nobody complains. As long as I stay out here in Utah. But when I go to LA or when I go to Houston, it's not too long before somebody pulls me aside and gives me the talk that I have given to other people about their BO. And so if you're going to do pair programming, and if you sweat a lot, and you don't like to wear antiperspirant, go get Dove's Men Care deodorant, which is they've got a variety of subtle fragrances, and they don't burn your arms and make you sticky, and they're hard to wash out. It gets rid of the smell for 48 hours. It's really nice.
All right. Good deal. James, what do you have for us?
listening to David's picks, I'm reminded of the Castle episode where the guy who makes men's products dies and Castle's all hung up on his products and getting the whole precinct hooked on them and stuff, and then they later find out they have these medical problems and everybody...
They have butane in them.
Right, yeah. Yep. Everybody gets mad, so I just had to share that because I think that was hilarious. So that's kind of a quasi-pick. I do enjoy Castle. It's a witty, fun show. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out.
Yes.
Okay. As far as picks, though, I have a couple. When I'm building a new site, I always struggle to find a usable background image, you know, pattern thing. And I inevitably end up making one, and it's absolutely horrible, you know, because I have no artistic skill whatsoever. So anyways, I got sent this cool site yesterday called subtlepatterns.com. And it's a great site of just a bunch of background images that aren't ridiculous. They look good. You can go through and preview them right there on the site and stuff like that. It's really handy. So if you're like totally unartistic as I am, then this site is definitely very helpful. And the other pick I have, just what I've been reading lately, I picked up the Kindle single of Sam Harris's new, it's really more of an essay than a book, called Lying. And I'm about halfway through that and really enjoying it. So if you haven't read Lying, you should do it. It's a Kindle single. It's like $1.99. And it's all about, you know, how do humans lie? Why do we lie? Is it okay that we lie? Stuff like that. And it's really, really excellent. So I recommend checking it out.
All right. Thanks, James. Josh.
Okay, so I said I'd say something about remote pairing in the picks. So remotepairprogramming.com. So that's a site set up by a former coworker of mine, Pivot Joe Moore. And he does remote pair programming all day long. He's in a remote office, so he remote pairs all the time. And he's been doing a lot of talks in the Atlanta Ruby user group and various places like that, talking about how to do remote pairing well. And so he set up a blog around it, and he's just been doing a lot of really good stuff there about what kind of tools to use and etiquette and practices and how to be effective. So that's definitely worth checking out. And then I have another pick for another pivot. Jeff Dean did a blog post this week about how to do your own object creation methods instead of using a fixture replacement library like, or you know, factory library like Factory Girl or the like. And I'm calling this one out because this is the blog post I've been meaning to write for a while. And this is a pattern that gets used at Pivotal a lot. I like this pattern. It's pretty much just about the same amount of effort to use this pattern as it is to use a library like Factory Girl, and you don't have a lot of the weird, quirky problems that you get with some of these libraries. I personally don't like the declarative syntax for doing test object creation because these things often need to be done in some sort of sequenced order. And using a declarative syntax for that is really hard sometimes. So just having methods where you have little snippets of Ruby code in there that do what you want to do works fine. This is a great post on doing it. So it's called Rolling Your Own Object Creation Methods for Specs. We'll have a link in the show notes. And then I have a last little pick here, which is The Adventures of Merlin, which I've been watching on Netflix streaming lately. And it's sort of... If you're a fan of the Arthurian mythos and, you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, and you like your classics classic, this will kill you because they've taken liberties with everything. They've reinvented everything. It's like Arthur is a kid growing up with or Merlin and Arthur as young kids growing up together. It's like, drives me nuts. But if you just set that aside, it's actually they're pretty true to the theme of the myths, and they get a lot of it right. So I've been pretty happy watching it. As soon as I set aside my classicist hat, I've been enjoying it a lot. So it's worth checking out.
All right. Yeah, I've watched a bunch of them, and then I stopped because I thought my wife would like it. So I'm trying to get her to watch them now. But yeah, anyway, so my picks, the first pick that I have is kind of, it's one of those non-concrete ones, and that's basically just community involvement. When I was out in Colorado this last week, I wound up after the podcast, Tim Peace told me that the Boulder RB group was getting together. So I drove the 45 minutes from where I was staying up to the Pivotal offices over in Boulder and went to their users group meeting. And then I also wound up having lunch with Fernand Galeana, who runs the Derailed group. And we wound up having a good chat. I was only planning on having lunch with him for like an hour or so, and we wound up chatting for like 3 hours. So, you know, it's just nice to be able to get together with people in the community. So if you're traveling or, you know, even in your local area, you know, find those communities and hook up with people, get to know them, you know, find out what they know, find out what they're good at, and make those connections, because it's not just what you'll get from them, but it really is a way of coming to appreciate the community that we have around Ruby and Rails, and you know, just some of the great people that are out there. So that's my only pick this week. I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up and just remind you that you can get the show notes at rubyrogues.com, and you can find us in iTunes, and you can leave us a review there. Just do a search for Ruby Rogues, and you should be able to find it in there. Thanks for listening, and next week we're talking about training with Mike Clark. Is that correct?
Yes, it could be Mike Clark. Yeah, specifically teaching Ruby.
Teaching Ruby, okay. So if you're interested in teaching Ruby, or, you know, I'm sure he's going to have some great tips. So looking forward to that next week. And don't forget to read our book group book, which we will be reviewing the beginning of December. It's Eloquent Ruby by Russ Olson. And that's it. Thanks for listening.
I feel like I need a cigarette.
Nice.